years older than I. He was my brother, 23 years old, the day he died.
In the freedom summer of 1964, three young men, James Earl Cheney, Andrew Goodman, and Michael Schwerner, went to Neshoba County, Mississippi to register black voters. They went missing and were discovered 44 long days later, buried in an earthen dam. August 4th, 1964.
This town's gonna be your burying place.
I'm Suzanne Lang, and this is A Novel Idea. 50 years after these horrific events, which further fueled the passing of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we look at Carolyn Goodman, Andy Goodman's mother. She herself was a social activist before the murder of her son and continued living her life as an activist until her death at age 91. Her memoir, My Mantelpiece, A Memoir of Survival and Social Justice, is a collaboration with author Brad Herzog, and he joins Rosemary Manchester in conversation on those difficult times and this remarkable woman. Before her death, Maya Angelou wrote the foreword to the book, and here Rosemary Manchester reads from it.
Carolyn Goodman and I liked each other very much. We just admired each other. Beyond that, there was affection, but there was admiration, too, because each knew who the other was. I knew she was a strong and loving woman, and she knew I was the same. Some people can be strong without love, and some can have love without strength. So they can't encourage people to go further, to be more ambitious. Love is such a wonderful encouragement. It's not just a feeling. It may be that which keeps the stars in the firmament. So I liked her and loved her. The murders of Andrew Goodman, James Cheney, and Mickey Schwerner rocked me to the core of my very being. I had grown up in a little village in Arkansas. Lynchings were not unusual, and they were legal as far as we could see. Nobody ever went to jail for them. So I was used to white men killing black men, but I was not used to white men killing white men because of black men. The difference. It was almost as if, in the former, they had license to kill black men. This is what they did. The Ku Klux Klan did that. They killed black men in various murderous ways. But killing young white men? I thought, these people are really mad. It was amazing to me. I had to look at the murderers with different eyes. It rocked me. So those murders in 1964 were shocking. And I felt for the mothers of the white boys. You see, the mother of a black boy knows that when he leaves home, she may never see him again, no matter where. But the white mother didn't know that. These three young men represent 300,000 young men and women who dared, who had the courage to go to the lion's den and try to scrub the lion's teeth. People live in direct relation to the heroes and the sheroes that they have always and always. Young people can look at the famous football player, the well-known baseball player, the golfer, and say, I want to be like that. Well, we have to have that in the civil rights movement. Some became famous because of what they said. We have to have the people who became famous for what they did. And I think those three are unmitigated heroes. So we have to lift them up and show them to the world so that some young man in Philadelphia or Tucson, Arizona says, I wonder, could I stand up for the right, even though it doesn't actually concern me? not knowing that by standing up for the right, he's actually doing the right thing for himself.
Brad Herzog writes what interests him and has written books for children and adults, including Turn Left at the Trojan Horse, A Would-Be Hero's American Odyssey, States of Mind, and Small World, A Microcosmic Journey. Here's Rosemary Manchester and Brad Herzog.
And I'm delighted to have in my studio Brad Herzog, who has just published a brand new book about a woman who has always been an icon to me, Carolyn Goodman. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yeah. I have so much I want to talk with you about. I was reading that one of your first motivations to write was Bilbo Baggins. Yeah. That's wonderful.
The Hobbit. Yeah, I read The Hobbit when I was in maybe fifth or sixth grade, and it sort of opened my eyes to the possibilities of the written word. That you could, you know, whatever was you were eager to write about, someone else might be eager to read about. And then actually a few years after that, I took a class in high school called Literature of Persuasion. And I read, we read Thomas Jefferson and Elie Wiesel and things like that. And it really opened my eyes that not only could you write, but you could change hearts and minds through your writing. And I think, I feel like my mantelpiece, this new book, is sort of a combination of those two things.
Yes. Well, you're a prolific writer. You have more than 30 books published and zillions of magazine articles. You're a hard worker.
Yeah, well, it's prolific out of necessity, I think, is making a living as a writer. I became a freelancer at a very young age, which is sort of unusual. Usually you sort of do that after you've been established writing career in some arena or other. And anything that appeals to me that I think is an interesting idea in various subjects, children's books and travel memoirs and nonfiction and picture books and you know, whatever interests me, I think might interest somebody else, and I like to pursue it.
Yeah, and you got your start in sports writing.
I did. I still do quite a bit of sports writing. I sort of look back on it and think of it as that was something I really enjoyed, and why not write about it? But I do think that my interest broadened and deepened as I got older, and I realized I didn't want to be John Q. sports writer. I wanted to be John Steinbeck.
Oh, don't we all?
Yeah. So I sort of look back on it and think, well, I didn't realize the possibilities out there for me as a writer, and I've come to realize that as I grew older.
Is this process of collaboration, which went into this book, is that a first for you? That
essentially, yeah. I mean, Carolyn Goodman and I collaborated to tell her life story. I mean, I like to think that I, in a sense, I've done that many times over the years, especially in writing magazine profiles. It's not considered a collaboration, but really the person that I'm interviewing, it's the same process.
Exactly.
The two elements of the process, and it was very important and difficult with this book, is number one, you got to get to know the person very well.
Yes.
You got to really feel like you know their voice and their sensibilities. But number two, you have to get the details of their life.
That's right.
And those are often two sort of contradictory things to have to pursue during an interview. You have to sort of keep on track with the facts, but also with the sentiment involved. Mm-hmm. Carolyn made it very easy for me. She was a brilliant woman. She passed away in 2007. But she was a brilliant woman who spoke very lyrically and anecdotally. And she may not have even realized that the story she was telling could be used as a metaphor by a writer. But she told one after another, and they were just so profound. And the subject matter was obviously very profound. And so getting her voice was rather easy. Getting the details was a little more difficult. She was in her 80s, and by the time we started collaborating, and only the person that you're writing about really knows the intimate details of their own life.
That's right.
And so to get all those was a little bit more difficult. But, you know, a story like this almost writes itself.
How did this all come about?
It's interesting. I've written three American travel memoirs about small town, my travels through small town America. The first one was called States of Mind. And what happened was my wife Amy and I spent a year on the road in a Winnebago in 1996. I turned to her one day when we were living in Chicago and said, "How'd you like to quit your job and we'll get a big RV and spend a year and I'll try to write a book about it?" And she said, sure. So we did it. And we did a 48-state journey, this life-changing – it's how we moved to California. It was a life-changing journey.
Wait, tell us again the name of that book.
It's called States of Mind.
States of Mind by Brad Herzog.
Yeah,
Make a note of that, folks.
I'm really proud of that book. And it's – the premise was that we went to – the backbone of this 48-state journey, the backbone was these 18 tiny little towns named after virtues – Harmony, California, Wisdom, Montana, Pride, Alabama, Justice, West Virginia, searching for virtues, those virtues in those towns, tiny little towns, 50 people, 100 people.
What about Happy Texas? Did that make
that
it?
That didn't make the cut, but it was
another story, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Neither did Intercourse, Pennsylvania.
Oh, yes.
So I was searching for those virtues, and one of those towns was Hope, Mississippi. And all I knew about Hope, Mississippi was that it was right next to Philadelphia, Mississippi, where the three civil rights workers, Mickey Schwerner and Andy Goodman and James Chaney, were murdered in 1964. And I thought, what a fascinating juxtaposition that there's a town called Hope next door. So we visited that town and drove around that town and read the details of that tragedy while we were driving around the town, which was a very creepy, eerie experience. And knowing that a lot of the men who committed those atrocities were still walking around town.
Right.
And toward the end, we came across an African-American woman literally on the outskirts of Hope. She had told us her story. We sat down. She was really reluctant to talk to us at first. And she finally opened up in her living room and in her little tiny house. And at the end of the conversation, she said, you know, I probably shouldn't tell you this, but I've heard that my landlord – had a part in those murders. And we asked his name, and she said Olin Burridge. And it turns out that Olin Burridge was the man on whose property the bodies were buried for 44 days. That's her landlord. So it was a real profound experience. And that's how I came to know the story of Schwerner, Chaney, and Goodman. And that's how I came to know about Carolyn Goodman. And I wrote a magazine article about her, and she really liked it a lot, and she asked me to co-author her memoirs with her. So that's how it happened.
That's wonderful how that all came to be.
Yeah.
If you hadn't gone to Hope, Mississippi, that's what started it.
Yeah, and the amazing thing is that to me, the story of Carolyn Goodman is a story of hope. It sounds strange to say it because she had so much tragedy in her life.
So much.
Yeah, her brother died when she was very young.
Yes.
Her father, she was molested as a child. Her father committed suicide 2 weeks before her wedding. Her son was murdered.
Her mother was terrible.
Her mother was awful. Her husband died of a stroke when he was 55. And yet the story that comes out of her life is one of turning anguish into activism and hope.
She was molested by her mother's
boyfriend
in the presence of her mother. I mean, I was reading through that. I thought, how could any woman survive this, let alone go ahead to have a wonderful, productive life in which she was always helping other people? It's a miracle.
I guess people react differently to different tragedies, and maybe she was able to sort of close off that part of her life and devote herself to a greater cause. And I think that's what happened even with her son Andy being killed, that she decided that she's going to turn his martyrdom into a mission to better the world. And she created the Andrew Goodman Foundation, and half of the proceeds from this book go to that foundation. So it's a very hopeful story. Yes. All this tragedy, and yet I feel like it's a story of triumph, and that's pretty amazing.
It is. And to me, I always knew about her. I lived on the East Coast. I was living in Westchester County when this all happened, and I had two sons in college, and I was active in Women's Strike for Peace. And so I was, you know, not exactly on the front line, but I was in there trying to get to the front line.
Right.
So I knew I had met the Schwerners. I didn't. You know, we all knew who they were, but I wasn't close enough to the to say that they were friends. But I met them, and you know, the sadness is just you never forget the sadness of those parents. I never met Carolyn Goodman. She lived in New York, and I lived in Westchester. Mm-hmm. But I always carried those names, Schwerner, Goodman and Chaney. Pete Seeger wrote the song, didn't he?
Yeah, Simon Garfunkel wrote a song about
that. Right.
I mean, there's a lot of
There
are actually a lot of memorials to them in various.
Yes.
There's a Goodman Mountain in upstate New York.
Wonderful.
Yeah, but my favorite memorial to them, and I talk about this in the book, is the favorite sort of a letter that Carolyn received from a 10-year-old girl.
Yeah, tell about that.
She received a lot of obviously condolences and well wishers letters especially during that summer where they were missing in 1964, and it was 44 days that they were
days.
That they were not found. Welcome. And everyone in Philadelphia, Mississippi, half the people knew who had committed these atrocities, but it was a...
And they wouldn't tell. They said it was a hoax.
Yeah, a lot of them were saying that.
You know, that's flinging it in the faces of the parents whose
right.
children
Well, especially dead. Some of the people... The sheriff was saying it was a hoax, and the sheriff was right. most likely involved. So it was
awful
terrible.
Stuff.
Yeah. But during that summer, she received a lot of letters, and one of them was from... She didn't have time to open a lot of them, but one of them, it said, sealed with a kiss on the back. So she knew it was from a child. And it was from this 10-year-old girl who... had gone to summer camp and followed the news story of the missing boys and thought Andy Goodman was just the most handsome thing she'd ever seen. And at camp, there was a cat there that had a litter of kittens, and one of them was this little black and white ball of fur, and she asked in the letter, can I name this kitten Andy?
Oh, my
and
goodness.
The girl's name was Robin Goodman, and she was not related, but so she said, we want to name him Andy Goodman. So that touched Carolyn Goodman more than any other letter that she received. And years later... she went to this Robin Goodman became an artist and did a showing at a gallery in New York City and invited Carolyn Goodman. They had lost touch over the years, but invited Carolyn Goodman, and Carolyn didn't even know what she looked like at that point. She was a middle-aged woman, this Robin mm-hmm. Goodman by then. Mm-hmm. And Carolyn looked at the artwork and was about to leave and heard someone say, Carolyn, and it was Robin Goodman. And they hugged for the first time, and Carolyn found out that Andy Goodman, the cat, lived with Robin Goodman's family for 15 years, and they loved Andy Goodman too. It's just a wonderful story.
And it's stories like that that make her a real person. I mean, she was an icon to me, you know, almost a saint. But I didn't feel any closer to her than that. But as I was reading your book and reading about her life and the way in which she shared the tragedies, other tragedies of her life, and then her struggles with grief, and then how she went on to get a doctorate, and when she was arrested at 83 years old. I she's a very real person to me now, thanks to you. In a sense, you've given her life, because any of us can pick up your book, My Mantelpiece, and read about the life of Carolyn Goodman.
Well, thank you. I love that you said that, because I feel like I've devoted a lot of my writing career to publicizing people who deserve to be publicized, and rather than writing about overrated people, I'd rather write about overlooked people. And not that she was overlooked, but her story needs to be told. 50 years after these murders, a life devoted to a greater good, it deserves to be told. And she. I'm glad that her voice can live forever, because it was quite a voice. I mean, she was a very real person. She wasn't perfect, you know. If she would say refer to something historical and I didn't know what she was talking about, she'd let me have it. She said, "You should know about that.
Know about this."
Yeah,
right.
And that's she was very real. And talking about these really intimate things with her, you get to know someone really well when you're talking about.
Yes.
Terrible tragedies and intimate moments, and you know, she would tear up, and but she was also a very strong woman.
Yes, strong women cry.
Yeah,
yeah. How did you? What was your role in it? Did you shape the chronology of the story? Did you? What did you do?
Well, I got her story. You know, anything like this, it happens in bits and pieces. And,
yes.
and we spent time together. I would go to New York and spend time mm-hmm. a few days with her, and then I'd go back home, and then I'd go back to Long Island at a vacation home and go there. And got her whole story and attempted to do it chronologically, but that never happens. And if there was a tangent and it seemed like a great place to veer off into, that was mm-hmm. great.
I like the way you handled the chronology. I mean, you didn't just go straight through.
Right.
You shaped it. That, and it was your shaping of the story. Your selection of what goes where,
right.
and placing it in.
Yeah, I decided to start the book with this moment that I think really encapsulated everything, where she had to give Andy, her 20-year-old son Andy, permission to go to Mississippi. He wanted to volunteer for Freedom Summer, which was this massive effort to flood Mississippi with about 700 Northern college students who were going to register African Americans mm-hmm. to vote and create freedom schools to educate them about their rights as citizens. And at that time in Mississippi, by the way, about 5% of the 500,000 African Americans there were registered to vote. And there were 8 out of the 13 mostly black counties where not a single black person had ever voted. And it's remarkable numbers. So it was a much needed aggressive movement. But that aggressive movement also, ironically, I suppose, re-inflamed the Ku Klux Klan in Mississippi. Oh. And it was this meeting that was almost a recipe for martyrdom. And so it was a dangerous mission. And, yes. and Andy wanted to go there. And he was underage, so he had to get permission from his parents. So she had this moment. She and her husband, Bobby, who I wish I could have met, who seems like the most beautiful man ever.
Wasn't he lovely?
Just his poems that are in the book and
lovely.
His letter to his dying mother that's in the book is just melts your
yes,
heart.
Right.
So they had this moment where they had to think, well, on the one hand, I want to protect my son. Mm-hmm. This is dangerous. Everyone wants to protect their child. On the other hand, he is a representation of what we are and what we have been in our years as activists and progressive and bold people. And basically she said to me, she said these very words, she said, how could we say no? Our That's lives, right. our values would have had a hollow That's ring. Right. So we couldn't say no.
That's right. And as you're reading and you come up to that point, you know, this parent at that time of sons of draft age, I remember the fear and the it was a terrible time for anyone. I mean, for parents, for children.
Right.
And she shines like a beacon. She and Bobby, they knew what he said, can I go? I need your permission to go. And they gave it.
And they also knew that he was going to volunteer for the most dangerous part of Mississippi.
Yes.
He had choices, actually. Two different field workers in Mississippi recruited him, Mickey Schwerner mm-hmm. being one of them.
Mm-hmm.
And this church burned in outside of Philadelphia, Mississippi, mm-hmm. and he chose to go down there and explore the church with them. And literally, they drove all night from Ohio, explored the ruins of this burned-out church that was firebombed by the KKK. And then on the way back, driving back, they got stopped for speeding, and they got put in jail for several hours, and they got finally released at night. And they had all these rules as these volunteers and field workers down in Mississippi, don't drive at night, always make a phone call, all these safety rules. They didn't make a phone call. They drove. Something was clearly wrong. They drove and at night, and they got stopped again. While they had been in jail, this ambush had been planned
yes.
involving the deputy sheriff of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. Mississippi, and about 15 or 18 members of the KKK in that area, and stopped their car for the deputy sheriff mm-hmm. turned his lights on, stopped them again. They got placed in another car, taken to this unmarked dirt road, and shot one at a time and buried. And were missing for 44 days. It galvanized the nation. It transformed the civil rights movement. Mm-hmm. And but it was also a thing to remember that I want to convey in this book is that every grand movement like that is also an intimate moment for the people involved, the
yes.
families.
Yes.
You know, it's somebody's son. It's someone's daughter. It's
yes.
brother. So I wanted to convey that as well.
And it's someone's son and daughter or uncle or aunt committing the crime.
Yeah. You know, I found out discovered this one fact. One of the men, 18 or 19 men that were arrested for the murders, and we can talk a little bit later about how they were not actually, most of them, convicted. But his granddaughter wound up being Miss America in 1986. So the Miss America 1986 from Mississippi, her grandfather was a killer.
Oh, the ironies.
Yeah.
Oh, my.
You're listening to Brad Herzog in conversation with Rosemary Manchester on Carolyn Goodman's memoir, My Mantelpiece, a memoir of survival and social justice, which Herzog co-authored. Let's take a break with some music inspired by the events of that summer.
I think of Andy in the cold, wet clay. Those three are on my mind. With his friends beside him on that brutal day, those three are on my mind. There lies young James in his mortal pain. Those three are on my mind. So I ask those killers, can you sleep again? Those three are on my mind. I see young Michael with his soft-eyed bride. Those three are on my mind. And three proud mothers weeping side by side. Those three are on my mind. But I breathe yet, and for some the sky is bright. I cannot give up hoping for a morning light.
So I ask those killers, can you sleep at night? Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind. I see the tin-roofed shanties where my brothers live. Those three are on my mind. And the burnt-out churches where they sing, we forgive. Those three are on my mind. While on the backwoods roads still ride the hooded bands, poisoning the air throughout the good Southland. So I ask those killers, can you ever wash your hands? Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind. There sit the mighty judges handing down the law. Those three are on my mind. In their marble courthouse we are filled with awe. Those three are on my mind. I know of Tom Paine's watered tree. I know the price of liberty. But I must ask that question that still burns in me. Did they also burn the courthouse when they killed those three? Those three are on my mind. Those three are on my mind.
You are listening to KRCV's A Novel Idea with Rosemary Manchester in conversation with Brad Herzog.
The fact that the story went on for 44 days is probably what kept that story, why we know about it.
Right.
If they'd solved the problem the next day and said, we found the bodies, we'd remember it sort of. But remembering those 44 days and reading about, I mean, you can, anyone who's a parent can imagine or can't imagine what that would be like.
Yeah, I think that, you know, the question, where are they? What happened to them? Yes. What was hovering over everyone's head? Mm-hmm. I do think that a very significant part of this was the fact that two of the three victims were white.
Yes.
It made a huge, huge difference. And it's a real shame. And the fact that really I cannot get out of my head is the fact that when they were searching for the bodies and they were looking in the rivers and swamps and forests of Mississippi, they didn't find those bodies, but they found other black bodies.
Other bodies,
yeah.
Yes. You just can hardly believe that that's the United States of America.
Right.
What were we thinking?
It was that kind of place, that kind of time, and that kind of difference between the resources and attention given blacks and whites. So these were missing. One of the bodies they found was never identified. It was a 14-year-old African-American boy wearing a Congress of Racial Equality T-shirt. And that just didn't get the attention of didn't capture the attention of America. So in a way, it's a shame that it had to happen to two white boys and one African-American young man. At least it got people's attention. And it really indirectly, I think, led to a passage of the Voting Rights Act in 1965. Yeah. It got people moving.
Yeah.
You know, one of the heartwarming things I've discovered in doing this book is that some of the wonderful people in Mississippi who played a huge role in Carolyn's life and in making and eventually getting justice for these murders. And one great moment was in 1989 when Carolyn went down to Mississippi for the first time, 25 years later. She set up a anniversary Freedom Summer and this Freedom Caravan and talked to people. And at one point she was in a big room and the Secretary of State of Mississippi, a man named Dick Mulpis, apologized for the events of 1964 in front of everyone to her face, and she said it was one of the most cathartic moments of her life, and they hugged in front of everyone, and that eventually led to the arrest and conviction of a man named Edgar Ray Killen, which is actually his name, who was the mastermind, and I use that term loosely, of the ambush. He 41 years later to the day, after there really had not been justice four decades earlier, he was convicted and he's spending he was an 80-year-old man at the time, but he's spending the rest of his life in jail, as he should.
It seems to me that quite often when there's an opportunity for reconciliation, for the protagonists to meet in a room and talk to each other, that like the reconciliation that took place in South Africa, I mean, it surely wasn't perfect. You know, they still have a long way to go. But there were opportunities for the victim and the person who was what do you call that other person?
The perpetrator.
The perpetrator. For them to meet in a room and talk. And with the possibility of reconciliation.
Yeah, well, I mean, Dick Mulvis had nothing to do with those murders from years earlier. I think the difference is that the actual people involved, there was no reconciliation. And Carolyn said she didn't want to see those people.
No. That you make a very important distinction.
Right. She didn't want to even think. And she said in a very profound way, she said, I don't want vengeance. I want justice. And I don't want to think about the people who did these terrible deeds. I want to think about all the good people in Mississippi who are doing great things. So.
She couldn't afford to have evil inhabit her life.
Right. Or, she felt it, though.
Oh, yes.
She felt hate.
She had to constantly hold it off, I think, because you can't let it take you over if you want to accomplish anything.
Right. And I think that's maybe one reason in her life she devoted herself to all these wonderful causes. And even the Andrew Goodman Foundation, one of their main focuses is youth activism and all these people who are, and she would remind them over the years that they're doing great things. She wanted to remind people that there are people doing great things now still, and they're standing on the shoulders of giants like Andy Goodman and Carolyn Goodman. And, you know, it's easy for one generation to say, oh, the new generation isn't doing what we did, but it is happening. And she especially focused on the Andrew Goodman Foundation, especially focused on intergenerational cooperation and, you know, paying it forward. And I think she wanted to focus on the good being done and perpetuate that.
And so, so often people who are active in social justice and people who've risked a great deal talk about the necessity when the time comes to step forward. And that's what Andy Goodman did. And his parents gave him permission to do that.
Yeah, I think when courage meets circumstance and you can I always say that if give me the circumstances and I'll show you some courage in my life. But you know, circumstances change throughout the years. There are a lot of people who say, well, no, young activists don't take the kind of risks that were taken then. Well, that may be true, but that's because there isn't that kind of environment. Even the sort of gay rights movement and the gay marriage movement, there are a lot of people doing some brave things, but it's not quite the same kind of bravery because back in 1964 in Mississippi, law enforcement was on the side of the bad guys.
That's right.
And for the most part. And so there was no protection. There was no, you know, the Freedom Riders of 1961 who would go down and I'm amazed by, you know, it wasn't just Freedom Summer 1964 where there was courage shown. The Freedom Riders would get off a bus, an integrated bus, and see a group of 300 people with lead pipes and guns and know they were going to get beat up and dogs. And they'd get off the bus anyway, and law enforcement would be standing a block away, knowing full well what was happening. So it was a different time and a frightening time. You know?
And it was the United States of America. I mean, is this taught in public schools? Are children these days aware of what it was like 50 years ago in the South?
You know, I wonder. My sons are in middle school right now, I have a feeling. It's not taught to the extent it should be. I have a bias about that in general. I think,
join the club. Yeah. Me too. Right. I'm terribly biased about it.
Yeah.
I
think history is undertaught.
Yes. And they're too selective. They cherry pick what they want to put in the history books.
Right.
And I would doubt if Mississippi has much to say about the atrocities. That
occurred. They're trying, though. You know, there are civil rights museums in Mississippi now, and there are people there who want to just embrace that, and but again, it's good and bad. You know, there's a memorial to the three boys down there, the three young men, I should say, down there, and which is great, but it's also been vandalized twice.
Yes.
So there's good and bad. But I do think the history, the aspect of teaching the courage of the civil rights movement in all its glory, is, you know, it's not just Rosa Parks.
That's right.
There's just a lot more to it. There's not just Martin Luther King, two courageous people, obviously.
Right.
And by the way, Martin Luther King went to Philadelphia, Mississippi 2 years later, and he said it was one of the scariest, most frightening moments of his life. There's a whole mob there, and he said there's a complete reign of terror here, is how he put it. And Even he was pretty terrified at back then. And that was a year before, that was 2 years after the murders, and a year before the trial, in which only, I believe, 7 men were convicted, no one for more than 6 years, because they weren't arrested for murder. They were, because that would have been a state trial, and that would have been a mockery in Mississippi. It was a federal conviction for depriving these young men of their civil rights, which they had a very limited sentence, and only six or seven out of the 19 men actually received the sentence, including the deputy sheriff, by the way. So it wasn't really justice at the time until many years later. And that shows how we have changed over the years, especially Mississippi.
I picked up a book in the library by Mary Winstead. You probably know the book. She's a white woman who moved north. Her family's in Philadelphia, Mississippi. And she went back to Philadelphia, Mississippi to family reunions. And her consciousness began to be raised about what members of her own family were involved in these atrocities. And of course, then she was writing a book, not necessarily about civil rights, about her family in the South. But as soon as they got wind that she was asking these questions, they closed ranks against her. They just practically disowned her. And I think that she was in some danger. And it occurred to me, I was thinking about the word Klan, the Ku Klux Klan with a K, how that, I'd be interested to know how they decided to be a Klan. But then I thought, well, the white people are a Klan as well. And this wall that goes up, you know, don't you expose anything wrong about, because she was actually related to Killen. He was an uncle. And she found that out. She tried to make contact with him, and he, you know, kept being so elusive that she never did, probably just as well that she didn't meet him. But what an interesting juxtaposition of loyalties there.
Within families, even.
In families.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting. Another fact that I came across is one of the 19 men arrested was a guy named Billy Wayne Posey, who was, I believe he was the guy who actually oversaw the burial of the bodies. Mm-hmm. And he had a cousin in the same town, Buford Posey was his name, was the cousin, who was one of the handful of people trying to do the right thing at the time and speaking out on the side of good and righteousness, and was essentially run out of town as a result. But this is a cousin of the worst and the best were related by blood. Right. And so I do think that a lot of people say, well, that was just the time and that's why everyone was like that. But when you see that a handful of people who were immersed in that very same environment, and yet there was something inside them that was said, this is not right. This is not how you treat people. Mm-hmm. It makes you realize that that's not an excuse just to say, well, I was raised in this place at this time. That's an answer, but I don't think it's a reason for being, you know, people. It's something that comes from within as well.
And I know they just hate it when those of us who were not raised down there in the South are going on and on about how awful this is. And I don't know how to feel about that.
Yeah, I've struggled with that too, because, like I said, you don't want to overgeneralize. And there are certainly lots of good people down there. One of them is this a writer for the Clarion Ledger in Jackson, Mississippi. His name is Jerry Mitchell, and he's been personally responsible. I've been in touch with him lately. He's been personally responsible for sort of reopening cold cases and getting these guys convicted for these famous civil rights murders back in the 60s. And that's really what he devotes himself to, and it's for years and years. And there's another man named Stanley Dearman, who was the editor of the Neshoba County Democrat, the newspaper in Philadelphia, Mississippi, for 34 years. And he was a voice of reason, a good friend of Carolyn Goodman. He was at her memorial service in 2007. And, you know, that's courageous. There are people who live down there. And as courageous as it was for Andy Goodman to go down there, he knew theoretically, at the end of the summer, he could go back. He can go back to New York. People who live down there, like James Chaney, the 21-year-old African-American friend, a colleague of his who was killed, and even Mickey Schwerner, who was a field staff worker down there at age 24, they had to stay down there. And that's even an extra dose of courage on their part. So all kinds of courage being shown.
And those of us who don't live in the South haven't got this whole thing all figured out either. I mean, it's not that we can, you know, take the moral high ground and look down on those dreadful people who don't understand that we're all equal. There's work to be done right where we are.
It becomes, in some ways, it's more insidious in other places.
Yes.
When it's less open and more underground, and but also there's an insidiousness now to the way racism is perpetuated legally in different ways. The Mississippi legislature just passed a bill that was basically a sort of a version of the vetoed Arizona keep away the gays bill, where businesses could not serve gay customers if it was against their religious freedom, quote unquote.
Yeah.
To me, that's just an insidious attempt to legalize intolerance. And even the Voting Rights Act of 1965 was recently kind of eviscerated by the Supreme Court. And then immediately a bunch of southern states made these changes, and where the end result is going to be that it's going to be more difficult for minority voters to vote. It's a more sophisticated way of doing it, but I'm not sure it's any better.
And we used to say that a few well-placed funerals would take care of a lot of it. But it's kind of scary that the next generation seems to be just as vindictive as the older generation.
Yeah, in other words, they're not. You'd think the racism would be sort of dying out.
That's right.
I think to some extent it is, certainly. But... yeah, I mean, you know, the work is never done. That's why Carolyn Goodman kept working. That's why the Andrew Goodman Foundation keeps working. That's why I wrote my mantelpiece, just to remind people that that there's still more to do.
Yeah, it's so the title of your book is so interesting. My Mantelpiece: A Memoir of Survival and Social Justice. Would you read in the beginning of the book the story of why it's called My Mantelpiece?
Sure.
I think that's so precious.
It is cute. David Goodman is Andy Goodman's youngest brother.
That's right.
Brother.
We haven't mentioned that he had two brothers.
Jonathan was his older brother, and David was his younger brother. Andy was the middle son. And David is sort of our partner in this book, where he's the president of the Andrew Goodman Foundation, and I gotten to know him very well. And I'm going to see him in New York in a couple of weeks. Carolyn told me the story about David when he was younger, and it was typical Carolyn in that it was this beautiful story that was something to it that I knew was useful. So I'll read it to you.
Okay.
So when my youngest son David was 7 years old, he came running home from school one day, breathless with excitement. In his hands, he held a large piece of construction paper, smothered in assorted colors, lines, shapes, and squiggles. In the eyes of a 7-year-old, it was a creation of unmatched brilliance. Monet and Degas and O'Keeffe all rolled into one. In fact, that's quite literally what it looked like. With the flamboyance only a true artist can exude, David boomed into our Upper West Side apartment, raised his magnum opus, and proudly declared, "Mom, come here, look at my mantelpiece." The story always made me smile. I treasured it and retold it because it evoked so much through so little. The exuberance of youth, the humor of language, the wonder of artistry, the power of approval. That David, perhaps trying to approximate the speech of his parents or the growing vocabulary of his older brothers, would substitute mantelpiece for masterpiece seems as profound as it is comical. The mantelpiece, after all, is where we keep our most prized creations, the photos and collectibles of loved ones and watershed moments. It is where we put our past and future on display. It is a self-portrait through faces and places, the me that we choose to show the world. A masterpiece is essentially the product of another's estimation. Someone else reviews your life's work and pronounces judgment. But a mantelpiece is a personal statement of values and choices, your life's work presented as a museum of the self. I have chosen to put mine into words, primarily because I believe lessons are the harvest of a lifetime, and I feel as if I have lived 100 lifetimes. I loved deeply, lost horribly, explored curiously. I surrendered friends to political paranoia, husbands to illness, a father to depression, and a son to hatred. I befriended icons, met presidents, fought fascists, found heroes. I was a victim and an inspiration, a martyr and an activist, a doctor and a patient. I mourned and celebrated and strayed and achieved and learned. My life has been a work of art, a wondrous, colorful, tragic, flawed, intimate, and epic work of art. This is my story. This is my mantelpiece.
Wonderful. That was Brad Herzog reading the words of Carolyn Goodman, and that's why the book is called My Mantelpiece. There's so much in that book we haven't even been able to touch on in this too short period of time, and I really encourage people to get their hands on this book and have the experience of it. It may be that you've never heard of Carolyn Goodman, that you don't know about the three civil rights workers, about Mississippi Summer and all that. Or maybe you saw the movie, but reading the book brings her to life.
One thing that's interesting about Carolyn Goodman is the fact that before Andy Goodman died, before her son was killed in Mississippi, she had devoted herself to many different forms of activism. In college, she helped organize farmers cooperatives during the Depression. In the 40s, she was part of the anti-fascist movement, the Abraham Lincoln Brigade.
Yeah. Right. So yeah. Few people even know about that.
Yeah.
Right.
And in the 50s, she had a bunch of friends who were victims of McCarthyism, and she would support them and raise money with quote-unquote birthday parties with them for them before they had to go to jail. And all this stuff. And I think that's what informed her son's worldview.
Yes.
And I think it's one reason he ended up volunteering. But she never said she regretted it. You know, she never said, I wish I had raised my son differently so he hadn't gone there, because that's not who she was. That's why when I went to her memorial service in 2007, it was overflowing with hundreds and hundreds of people. And Mayor Bloomberg of New York City spoke there. And Congressman John Lewis was there. And he said that Carolyn Goodman got in the way. She got in trouble. It was necessary trouble. It was good trouble. And she made the rest of us want to get in more trouble.
Wonderful.
And I think that's really well describes her, that she was not going to keep her mouth shut. And that's what she was all about.
A life well lived. It must have been such a pleasure to spend time with her.
It was an honor. It was intimidating. It was enjoyable. And you really get to know someone when you start with their ancestors and you go to them actually talking about their notion of what they want their memorial service to be. When you take them through the course of their life and you talk it through, you really get to know someone. And I was never bored, I'll tell you that.
Did she live long enough to have the book? To see the book,
She saw parts of it. You know, it languished for a long time, and then she passed away. And her son David asked me to finish the manuscript, and I finished it. Sort of languished a little, and now it's the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. Yeah. We thought, what a perfect time to publish it. It's published by Why Not Books, which is.
Well, tell me, what's Why Not Books?
Why Not Books? You know, I've published 30 some books in my life, but a couple of years ago, I started my own little publishing imprint. To sort of change my paradigm a little bit creatively and financially, and partner each book that I produce with a relevant charity, a relevant nonprofit, and publicize that. We called it Why Not Books. It comes from this famous George Bernard Shaw quote, you see things as they are and ask why. I dream things that never were and say why not. Mm-hmm. So we call it Why Not Books. And so we were able to publish my mantelpiece on the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. We're giving half the money to the Andrew Goodman Foundation. And it feels good. You know, I'm able to give back on a writer's income. You can't give back as much as you'd like to. But through this, I'm able to feel good about that. Yeah. You know, our little tagline that I came up with is good books and good karma. So if somehow down the road we can make this a bigger thing and get people out there who deserve to be out there and their work out there, that would be another good thing.
Yeah. You're onto something.
Yeah, we'll see.
That's great. And the wonderful achievement of giving Carolyn Goodman's life to us so that she's more than a tragic icon. She's a human being who lived so bravely and accomplished so much.
Yeah, I'm so proud of it. I'm actually going to New York City in a few weeks, and I'm talking at Westchester County, where you lived, at the Westchester Reform Temple. I'm giving a talk there. But
Great. But
the next night, there's a little more intimate gathering that's going to be happening in Manhattan at Carolyn and David's old apartment on the Upper West Side. The woman who lives there now is hosting this event, and David's going to be there. And I think it's really going to be a profound moment because, you know, I know David's really proud of his mother and joyful that this book is telling her story and to sort of talk about that with some of her intimate friends in that place where all this sort of happened in her apartment and where these news people gathered for 44 days trying to find, and the FBI agents were there. It was sort of this epicenter of activity. I think that's going to be a great moment.
It's hallowed ground.
Yeah.
Yeah, it really is. Yeah,
and rent controlled at the same time.
rent controlled hallowed ground. I like it. But to think that the vigil that went on there and ended so tragically. I doubt if they thought that he really might have survived whatever had happened.
No, Carolyn didn't want to let herself think that he was dead. She knew in the back of her mind that he probably was. Mm-hmm. But she
have to get through the time.
Home. Yeah. Right. And there's another great moment that I talk about in the book that I thought was profound, where after they found the bodies, these news people who have been gathering for weeks all sort of turned off their cameras and closed their notebooks and sort of stood in a line and all gave their condolences to Carolyn and Bobby Goodman. And this one newspaper man said, I'd never in my 60 years that I've ever seen that happen. And that just shows how much it affected even the journalists who were supposed to be so objective about everything.
Yeah. I came across a quote from Nelson Mandela. Service to others is the rent we pay for our place on earth.
Oh, that's good.
Isn't that great?
Yeah. I feel like that is words that the Goodman family lived by and still does. David Goodman was recently interviewed by Tavis Smiley on TV, and Tavis said, I think it's, what a noble cause that your brother gave his life for. And David actually said, not to correct you or anything, but he didn't give his life. His life was taken from him. And I think that's an interesting distinction too. Everyone wants to do good. No, Andy Goodman didn't go there expecting to lose his life. There was a courage to go there, but he didn't give his life away. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Sure.
I really, really enjoyed talking with you, Brad. And thank you so much for writing this book. And we look forward to hearing what you're going to do next.
Thank you, Rosemary.
Yeah, so thanks so much.
You've been listening to Rosemary Manchester talking with Brad Herzog. The book is My Mantelpiece, a memoir of survival and social justice, just published by Why Not Books. We opened the show with Simon and Garfunkel performing He Was My Brother, a song Simon wrote for Andy Goodman, whom he knew from school. Pete Seeger was at the break with Those Three Are On My Mind, and we'll go out with Tom Paxton's reflection, Goodman, Schwermer, and Cheney. Thanks for joining us. Beginning next month, you can hear us on the first Sunday of the month at 4, and Gil Manzurg and Word by Word will be moving to the second Sunday. Regardless, every Sunday we feature literary programming on KRCB. We're the new 91. You can listen to our show on podcasts, on iTunes, or at krcb.org, where you can subscribe. We've had production assistance from Sean Knight. I'm Suzanne Lang. Thanks for listening. It's a novel idea.
The night air is heavy, no cool breezes blow. The sounds of the voices are worried and low, desperately wondering and desperate to know about Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney. Calm desperation and flickering hope, reality grapples like a hand on the throat. For you live in the shadow of 10 feet a row, if you're Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney. The Pearl River was dragged and two bodies were found, but it was a blind alley for both men were brown. So they all shrugged their shoulders and the search it went on for Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney. Pull out the dead bodies from the ooze of the dam. Take the bodies to Jackson, all according to plan. With the one broken body, do the best that you can. It's the body of a young James Cheney. The nation was outraged and shocked through and through. Call J. Edgar Hoover, he'll know what to do. For they've murdered two white men and a colored boy too, Goodman and Schwerner and Cheney. James Cheney, your body exploded in pain, and the beating they gave you is pounding my brain. and they murdered much more with their dark bloody chains. And the body of pity lies bleeding. The pot-bellied copper shook hands all around and joked with the rednecks who came into town. And they swore that the murderer soon would be found. And they laughed as they spat their tobacco.
Thanks for listening. It's KRCV's A Novel Idea.
Together we shall not be.